Coming up, we're going to talk about the American Indian. I think you'll find it an intriguing conversation. I think one of the most interesting books I have read in a long time.
Views expressed are those of hosts, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of News Radio 1040 WHO.
Seldom have I devoured a book like the one I have in front of me right now. It's called The American Indian. Subtitle, A Standing Indictment Against Christianity and the Statism in America. This is not a new book. Much of the material in it is at least a half a century old. Is that not correct, Mark Rustooney? This is material your dad wrote a half century ago. Is that correct?
Some of it was written while he was on the Indian Reservation, which he left in 1953. Much of it he actually wrote close to 40 years later, though, in the 80s and early 90s.
Ah, okay. On the basis of the, I remember your dad, a prolific writer, prolific speaker, used to. The rumor was that he tried to read a book a day. Do you think that was true, or is that just folklore?
No, that was true for much of his life.
How do you do that?
Well, he was obviously a very fast reader.
In that, but, yeah.
But more importantly, he had a phenomenal memory. And he could remember what he read, and he could find a book, and he could find what he needed out of that book years later.
Do you have a brain like that?
No, I wish I did.
Where do you get those, by the way? And is there a sign-up list? Because in my next life, I want one.
It certainly aided him in his writing, because he could draw on a wealth of information.
Now, I'm wondering, just this snotty question, totally unrelated to your book here, do you have a chunk of the Ark anywhere in your house?
Pardon?
A chunk of the Noah's Ark?
No. Actually, my wife and son and I did visit Mount Ararat this summer, though.
The reason I'm asking is because, according to some of your background stuff, your dad lived in Armenia and lived near Mount Ararat. Is the mountains of Ararat is where the Ark allegedly came to rest following the Great Deluge.
That's partially correct. His parents were from Armenia. He was actually conceived in Armenia, ancient Armenia, historic Armenia.
Okay.
He was then in the Turkish Empire. And they left during World War One, during the time of the massacres of the Armenian people. And he was born in New York City just after they arrived.
Well, so he learns English in public schools. He goes to the University of California, Berkeley, gets a B.A. He gets a master's in education, and he gets, a seminary degree in Berkeley as well, ordained a Presbyterian minister. And he goes off to a reservation in Nevada to be a missionary. Why?
Well, he said there were several reasons. One, he felt a compassion for the Indian people because he did think that in many ways they had been mistreated. And he also wanted a remote area where he could continue to study. And the reservation afforded him the opportunity to do a tremendous amount of reading.
What did he want to study? And what kind of reading? And what was there about being there in the reservation that gave him that kind of discretionary time?
Well, the winters were very brutal, and often they were snowed in for extensive periods of time. And so he was able to buy books and have them delivered, and then he was able to read them during these down times. But he read voraciously. He read on all sorts of topics.
Brilliant fellow.
Yeah, he was very eclectic in his reading as well as his writing. He was primarily a minister and so a theologian. But he also wrote about history, he wrote about education, he wrote a little bit about science. He wrote about a number of topics, all from a Christian perspective.
And the left is still trash-talking him.
Yes.
So that's a good sign.
I think so.
So the American Indian, Did he talk about this experience? You were born later, I'm assuming, or did you ever have any?
Yes. I had, my four sisters were born during those years he was on the Indian reservation. I was born a year after he moved to California. But he did recall that time very fondly. For family reasons, he thought it was necessary to leave. But I think he would have enjoyed staying there even longer, despite the problems that he saw there. And it was a time of a great difficulty for a young pastor, because he dealt with all sorts of problems, including, you know, drunkenness and bailing people out of jail, and also the social problems that were endemic to the reservation.
I have so many questions here, Mark. I want to take a short time out before we get started, but I'm just going to tantalize people just by a quote from your introduction. The white man wanted what we had, our land, but he didn't want us. We wanted what the white man had, his improvements, his guns, his modern conveniences, but we didn't want him. And so,
yes.
And so we fought, each wanting what the other had, but not wanting the other, and trying to eliminate him. We lost. That's our story. We'll take up the story at this point. The book is called The American Indian, Standing Indictment Against Christianity. I'll ask him about that. And Statism in America. R.J. Rustuni, the author, back in a moment.
Find new roads.
If you love history and you don't trust the current politically correct observations, and I feel your pain, this book called The American Indian, it's an indictment against Christianity and statism in America. R.J. Rustuni, the author. Mark Rustuni is on our newsmaker line. All right, this is, gives me an opportunity also, Mark, to get a totally 100% accurate ruling on how to pronounce something. Is it Chalcedon or is it Chalcedon?
We pronounce it Chalcedon.
Why?
There are alternate translations that have been used throughout history, and one is more of a Chalcedon, and the other is Chalcedon, and we've always preferred the Chalcedon.
What does it mean?
Chalcedon is the name that of an early church council in 450 A.D., and that church council was the one that sort of settled the whole issue of the incarnation of Jesus Christ, and it said he was fully God and fully man in one person. In other words, he wasn't partially God or a man who became God or the Spirit of God just hovering in human flesh, around human flesh. So it said he was fully God and fully man. And that had great implications not only for theology but also for history, because if there's only one link between God and man, that's Jesus Christ, then the state couldn't claim to be God, the church couldn't claim to be God. The only access to God was through Jesus Christ. And so it meant that no man or no institution could claim an undue amount of authority over man or power over man.
Okay. So you're the second, third, fourth, fifth, or sixth generation of Rushdoonies thinking these great, thinking about these things. Back to the American Indian, the Shoshone tribe, and it was in Nevada. Why that particular group? And tell us a little bit about the Shoshones.
Well, the reservation included Paiutes and Shoshones, and they were actually somewhat different, and their tribal organization was quite different. Their language was similar, and they could understand each other, but their social structure was different. But in the infinite wisdom of the U.S. government, they decided to put them onto one reservation.
The Hatfield and McCoys.
Right. Well, they weren't so much warring. It's just that they were very two different people. The Paiutes, for instance, had a different social structure. Their leaders made the decisions for them. The Shoshones were what we would call democratic people. The individual Shoshones had to agree on a policy before they moved forward. So they were different people, but they were combined on the one reservation, the Duck Valley Indian Reservation in northern Nevada, and it actually extends into Idaho as well.
It still exists, I'm figuring.
Yes, it does.
Bigger, smaller, about the same?
I'm not sure how it compares today in size with what it was then.
Did your dad learn the Indian languages or dialects, or did he try, or what do you think?
No, I remember when we were kids. Now, again, I was born after that, but some years later, I can remember as children, we would sing some Shoshone songs, like some Christmas carols in Shoshone.
Okay.
But I don't believe he actually learned the language.
It's really difficult. We just honored, and some folks here in Iowa just honored some of the legacy of the Meskwakis. That is a regional group here in Iowa, because they were part of the Code Talkers in World War II. We're still thanking that group for its contribution. Were the Shoshones or the Paiutes also involved with that?
I don't know if they were involved in that or not.
Okay.
They tended to use very restricted. I didn't know there were any other Indians involved in that other than the Navajo, and they had such a unique language.
I didn't either until this morning. I didn't know them, but they were given some recognition. But anyway, back to the point of the book here, a standing indictment against Christianity and statism. What do you mean by that?
Well, that has to do with the reservation system, which my father saw as very destructive of the Indian, because you have to remember the reservation system was long before, Mao Zedong, long before Lenin. It was an experiment in socialism. It was a controlled economy. It was a top-down authority where people were guaranteed cradle-to-grave security if only they stayed within the system. And so this was a form of socialism, and we tried to apply it to the Indian, even while the rest of America was enjoying the benefits of private initiative and capitalism. And it destroyed the Indian. And the Indians that became successful really are those that moved off the reservation. But many wanted to stay on the reservation because they wanted to stay in close association with those they knew and those they loved. So they didn't all stay there just because they wanted the security. But nevertheless, they were trapped in a system that did them and their families and their people really a great harm. And the criticism of Christianity is that the churches, and now we're going back to the 19th century, the churches supported the reservation system because they thought if we keep all the Indians together, this is a way to evangelize them. This is the way to impact them for good because they won't be scattered. They'll be all together. So they saw that somehow this was a means of furthering a Christian work and a civilizing force amongst the Indians.
This is in the, early 30s, middle of the 30s, during the last century, right? And that meant that your dad had access to Indians at that time who were very, very old, who were could remember a time when they were not on reservations and they were self-supporting and they remembered the old ways. Talk to me about that.
He was there from 1944 until 1953. But he did talk to a number of Indians who remembered seeing their first white man. Some had actually fought the white men in the Western conflicts. He remembered talking to Indians who remember as children being forced onto the reservation. Some even, remember that they had been taught as children to hunt with bow and arrow. So he had talked to that older generation who remembered the old ways, who had themselves been taught by their parents and grandparents. So we're talking about a direct legacy of the old ways that went back generations. And yet he also saw the GIs coming back from the war who had a whole new world exposed to their experience. And he also saw the impact of public education on the Indian, and he saw that they were being somewhat controlled now by the same educational forces that were controlling the rest of the country. So the younger generation of the Indians was then picking up some of the romantic notions that were being taught in the textbooks and in the schools.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when we think of a people, when we think of ourselves, we want to think of ourselves as we are now and as we hope to be in the future. We don't go back 100 or 200 years or more and saying that's what we should be like. We should return to the old ways. People don't want to go back to horse and buggy days, much less, you know, when the European tribes were barbarians. Well, the Indian was very pragmatic. He was a survivor. In fact, repeatedly in this book, my father points out that that's how the Indians thought of themselves, the older generation. We were survivors. And it was survival was very difficult. And they had to change, they had to adapt in order to survive. For instance, when the Spanish let horses go wild or they abandoned them, the Indians very quickly learned to use the horse. Because they had the horse, they could chase the buffalo seasonally. And so the whole teepee culture of the Plains Indians developed after the coming of the white man because they used that as a means to move themselves in their encampments. The Indians wanted the technology of the white man. They saw it was definitely to their advantage to have his tools and such. They wanted the guns. The Indians did not want to be stuck in a backward way. The romanticism of the Indians is to say this is what an Indian should be and then to try to make him fit into that mold.
With the artifacts of the past.
Right. And the Indians were constantly frustrated that people thought of them in terms of artifacts, in terms of ritual. And they didn't really see them for what they were. And they often felt that they were being treated as museum pieces that people wanted to them to be real Indians, that is, as their parents or grandparents once were. And whereas the rest of American culture wanted to develop and grow and change with the times, they wanted the Indian to stay the same, and they thought they were doing him a favor by insisting that he stay the same.
And keeping them in a primitive subsistence situation.
That's in effect what the reservation did. Often the reservations were on the poorest land, land that no one else really wanted, or that was at the time vacant and available, and they shuttled them off there and made their existence very difficult. So it made it difficult for them to economically.
So it's interesting, you mentioned that the Christianity, in some degree, institutional Christianity, it thought the reservations were a great way. Put them in there, and then we can work them over and get them in one place, and we can convert the little varmints. It's the same attitude, Mark, that the early church had about public education. You say, hey, oh, you got all these immigrants coming into the United States from countries, including Catholic countries. Let's lock them into public education where we can work them over with Protestant Christianity, and we can duplicate culture that way. And using that kind of power, and they once Christians lost the reins of control, competing worldviews and philosophies took over the reins of public education, and now the Orthodox Christians are on the outside looking in, and they've lost control of that institution, and it's had the opposite of effect of their intentions, pretty much like the reservation system has had.
Yes, it's very comparable, and of course the same public education was brought to the reservation. And when my father was there, he very clearly saw the divide between the old generation and the younger generation who wasn't interested, who really didn't know. The younger generation began identifying them with this romanticized image of what they should be from their public education. So they were really getting the definition of what it meant to be an Indian, not from their parents and grandparents, but from white culture. So much of what we think of about the Indian is a creation of white America. For instance, the whole name Indian is a false one. The Indians did not consider themselves a racial group. Each tribe considered themselves as separate and distinct, and they were offended that they would be lumped together with other peoples.
And is it also true that, I think I read in your book, that even the concept of tribe is an invention of Christianity? we considered each one of their groups as to be a specific tribe in the biblical sense, but I think you wrote that just their tribes were just extended families.
That's correct. The tribes were often as small as a family group, and the tribes themselves, the name tribe actually comes from the biblical word for the tribes of Israel. And we just identified these different groups as tribe, and we tended to apply that to what we perceived as one group of Indians.
Well, we should be calling them the Johnsons and the Smiths and, and the Andersons, right?
To a very large extent, because even the tribes themselves rarely came together because it was difficult to survive that way. They didn't have that kind of economy, so they broke up into small units, and they lived separately. The only unifying factor, you could say, was a particular language group.
Let me quote your book. Take any 100 people from any city in the United States, place them on a reservation, and tell them, now you don't have to work for the next 20, 30, or 40, or 50 years. All you have to do is report to the government agent and get your rations, and you get your benefits. That's all. What you do in your time is your own. You'll wreck their character that way. The Indian forgot how to hunt, forgot how to fish, forgot how to do anything except sit, vegetate. The result was the total destruction of the Indian character. Instead of the self-reliant, independent person he'd always been, the Indian became a person without character, without any integrity, shiftless, insecure, alcoholic, and diseased. Wow, that's a pretty tough indictment.
Although I should point out, the book generally isn't, it doesn't come across as critical of the Indian. What it's criticizing is the government-imposed policies, the reservation system that served to destroy the Indian. And we have to remember, too, that most Indians never ended up on the reservations. Indians, to a very large extent, intermarried with the American people. This was particularly true in California. In fact, the numbers in the tribes in California were devastated with the gold rush because you had all these men coming and they wanted women, and they found Indian women and they married. And so there's Indian blood throughout the Americans. Years ago when I taught school, I would often ask the students, you know, what ethnic group are you? We were talking about immigrants. I said, what ethnic group are you? How many Germans are in here? How many English? Etc. And then I'd ask how, and a few hands would raise up, you know, out of an entire class for each ethnic group. I says, how many people have Indian blood in them? And 2/3 of the class would raise their hands.
I'd be in the list. Not me, my side, but my wife's side. There's some Cherokee swimming around in the gene pool.
And the same with my wife. And this is really what happened. We didn't kill off the Indians. We absorbed.
We borged them.
Yeah.
We will assimilate you. Resistance is futile.
So we have to remember that's another myth that, we fell on our knees and then we fell on the Indians.
Do you have a few more minutes here, Mark? I'll take a short time out here. For me, this is to rediscover stuff we should have been thinking about. And we put aside some of the mythology and some of the Hollywood stuff, and we just get real about ourselves and our neighbors and the previous occupants of the land upon which we now sit. It's called The American Indian, and R.J. Rushdooney compiled this over years, and his son is here, having put this all together in a book that I highly recommend. It's one of those things that'll cause you to think and ponder, maybe more than you're normally comfortable with. Back in a moment on 1040 WHO. Bye. The American Indian, that's the name of the book here, and R.J. Rushdooney wrote it, and his son, Mark, compiled it and released it before the rest of us to see this, And I've really enjoyed reading this, Mark, because it recovers some history and it recovers some common sense and it erases some of the nonsense and mythology that gets served up. During the first hour today, we talked with an expert on advertisements, an ad agency expert, and who said one of the things that changed American perception is the crying Indian commercial that we all watched when we were growing up about environmentalism. It's almost humorous to realize the guy wasn't even an Indian. He was an Italian guy wearing a wig. He got away. But we're easily manipulated by all of these Hollywood images. Your dad's insight here about the character issues that that it created by the reservation system, is it safe to conclude that he was concerned that not just these tendencies existed in the welfare state of the reservation system, but the American culture was moving in the same direction for everybody?
Yes, many of his comments about the problems of the American India were tempered with the fact that the rest of American culture was now catching up with the reservation system. And that we were having the same character problems, the same alcoholism, the same suicide rate. We were basically catching up to the damage we inflicted on the Indian on the reservation. So the problems are now extending far beyond the reservation. And partly it to blame is the fact that we've adopted the same socialistic mindset and the same socialistic policies for all of American culture as we did on the reservation. They were, in effect, the prototype of what America is becoming, and we're suffering the same problems as the Indians did early on. There was an account that my father mentions in the book, and it was about he had dinner with in a remote cabin with the returning GI, and they were looking out over the reservation, and this GI, who had traveled extensively with the military and he had seen much of the country, he said, "These people have reservation fever, and they're not good for anything because they're just waiting for a handout." And he said, but America has the same problem. They're just looking for somebody to do something for them." And he says, now all of America has reservation fever.
Whoa.
And my father thought that was a very perceptive comment. I mean, we're talking over half a century ago. But I think to a large extent, our political direction is one of reservation fever. We want cradle-to-grave security, but it comes at a price.
The price is dependency. Despondence.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You write, there was this, I can't remember at the moment here, but you write about the frustration because people know that they're being self-destructive. You write, there is a relationship between permissiveness and false perfection. In both cases, people want the world on their terms. One intelligent but alcoholic young Indian man rejected, without hesitation, all external standards and requirements in just two words. Why anything? He said, that's a broken culture. Indian life was without the presuppositions which are normally basic to life. Many Indians were far better at practicing existentialists than Jean-Paul Sartre. Why anything sums up the problem of many Indians as well as the general white American culture. Now, that was written a long time ago. You made that observation. I had a conversation yesterday, Mark, with a frustrated father whose son, he's invested a great deal of time and energy and efforts in spending extra money helping this kid learn how to read and recover some of his lost academics. And he's made a great deal of progress on the skill of in the academics. Now he didn't have the ability to learn. Now he has the ability, and his father is looking at this kid and says, "Well, now you've got the ability. why aren't you using it? Why aren't you applying it? And the father is frustrated, increasingly frustrated, at the indolence of his kid. And wonders, all right, what's this kid's future? I've spent all this time and money helping him get the tools of success. And the kid's response is, why bother? And you just talked about reservation fever. I just gave you another example of it from yesterday's conversation, I think.
It's easier to train character out of someone than to train it into someone. The old Indians had to survive. They knew what they had to do, and they would do it. You know, if you were lazy, if you were stupid, you didn't survive in the early Indian culture. And so they knew what they had to do, and they did it. There weren't so, you know, you couldn't be a social rebel in Indian culture. You needed the tribe, and you needed that stability.
It took a village
in order to survive. And so in that type of a primitive, you know, environment, that's really what it was all about. And that went on for generations. We destroyed that really with the reservation system, because the reservation system was the exact opposite. And within a couple generations, that was really trained out of them.
I'm going to at risk annoying you here, Mark, because I'm just a, you know, I have a snotty sideways brain. But I was reading your book here, and the older Indians despised both whites and younger Indians, imbued with romantic ideas about their past, because they knew what the old life was like. The scholars questioned about their life was like was its meaning and what the character of its culture and reflected about the abstract realms of the white man university. And I was very bluntly told the entire sum of Indian life was just two words, staying alive. And this is the snotty part. The Indian culture invented disco. Who knew, Mark, that the Bee Gees were Shoshones?
Yes. That was duly snotty.
I'm sorry. I need to take a last time out here. Mark Rushdoony is on our newsmaker line. We have one more short segment with him. The American Indian is just one of those things. You read this. Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, that explains this. Oh, I got hustled here. I got worked over there. This sorts this out. I better not feel superior over here. And oh, my goodness, this what's happening here? And am I a reservation Indian? Back in a moment at 1040 WHO. We have just a few more moments with Mark Rushdoony, the compiler of The American Indian. It's a brand new book I recommend highly. The insights will keep you going for a while. Mark, this morning on my Facebook page, I posted a quote that says, there's no such thing as a primitive individual, a primitive person. There's only primitive ethics. I think you guys agree with that, right?
I would say so, yes. Man is fairly uniform, and it's man's character that is the real distinctive that separates men.
So you talk about a Native Americans, however you want to describe the Indians or whatever phrase you want. You said they were bright, they were fierce, they were intelligent, extraordinarily resourceful, inventive, and what... I said to some of the listeners that I was dialoguing with, the army defeated them militarily, but the reservation destroyed them. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's very true. And you see a very different pattern amongst the Indians that went on the reservation versus those that did not.
Should the reservation system be dismantled and taken apart?
It would be a benefit to the Indian if we gave them the same advantages that the rest of American culture has. For instance, private ownership of land, the ability to transfer that land, to sell that land. It wouldn't be an easy thing, because once you destroy a people and then if you turn them out on their own, they're going to make some irresponsible decisions. So it's not an easy thing. It's like when you subsidize, you know, a child into adulthood, and then suddenly when they're 45 or 50, you cut them off.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a pretty sight for that individual. And so we've done a tremendous amount of damage, but further subsidizing them and with this paternalistic attitude that we have to take care of them and we have to protect them from themselves is really destroying them.
It's the best example that I can give a contemporary that most of us get easy access to. We watch a program that's on one of the cable channels called the Alaska Trooper, the State Troopers. And they show the total destruction of the Inuit culture in Alaska because they're just reservation subsistence, they're reservation Indians. And they wait for the next check to arrive, and then they drink it and then into a stupor, and then the process starts all over again. Mark Rushdoony, thank you for your expertise. This was a powerful, powerful insight.
Expressed are those of hosts, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of News Radio 1040 WHO.
Holiday baking? Don't forget the eggs. IowaEgg.org.
Every once in a while, I get fixated on stuff, and I start reading stuff, and I say, oh, every time I turn the page, this gets more delicious and better, and I like it. I think it is because in the case of the book and the author I was talking to during the last hour, I have so many ways of relating to the central thing. This book on the American Indian, it relates to so many of the social issues and so many of the hardcore character issues that we are still struggling with. And we're trying to figure out are there any external ways to extract civilization from the next generation. And watching the struggles of our country's history here, lots of lessons for us today. And I'm going to just recommend this little book. I'm going to read you something, though. You know I could be talking about politics and and all the malarkey that's being served up by the political class, all kinds of other things to talk about. But there's always time for that. There will be more time, perhaps. Maybe even tomorrow we'll talk with David Barton, who's going to be visiting us, and some other stuff. But I thought I found a chapter in this little book, because Iowa has, we have both Native Americans here, we have some tribes here, and we also have something in common with a tribal affinity for one of the animals in the animal kingdom. It was even an object of worship for many, many different Indian tribes. What beast? Well, there's several that they had affinity for, the wolf being some. Sometimes it was other animals. But the coyote, I have not seen one yet here in Iowa. I want to. Every time I mention this, I get calls and pictures and emails from listeners all over the state saying, how can you miss them? They're everywhere. Well, I haven't seen one yet. But there's this little chapter in this book that I thought you'd find interesting. Much has been written about the Western Indian and his views on the coyote. Stories about the coyote as a trickster are many and have been collected by anthropologists. The stories are accurately recorded, and it is true that there's much in them and about the cleverness of the coyote and the tricks he played. All the same, the emphasis is, I believe, rather faulty. There's no question the coyote is clever. He has not only survived and increased, but has spread all over the continental United States. He exists now in greater numbers than ever before, whereas his cousin, the wolf, has not so flourished. A very remarkable and superior Indian woman, Annie Pryor, lived not too far away from me, an aged person, but still attractive and commanding in appearance. She told me that coyotes would kill and eat her chickens on her doorstep. If she tried to drive them off, they would move just a few yards away and continue their meal. Only the sight of a gun and the knowledge that this person could use it would make the coyote disappear. Shortly after arriving at Owyhee, that is the name of this village, O-W-Y-H-E-E, it's a Shoshone village in Nevada, I saw an attempt made to control the coyotes, which had become very numerous and bold. The means devised to kill off the coyotes, clever, men wearing rubber gloves, prepared poisoned meat that was loaded onto an airplane and dropped all over the reservation in isolated places. Just as no human hand had touched the meat, no human tracks led to its landing spot on the ground, it was a clever plan. And soon, there were dead coyotes everywhere. But this trick never worked again. The coyotes were soon as thick as ever. And the older Indian's reaction to this was one of both delight and concern. They were concerned because the coyotes would sometimes kill old calving cows and their young. They were delighted because once again the coyote had tricked men, and this time clever white men, who believed that a solution to the coyote problem could be found. And now we come to the coyote's meaning to these older Indians. The coyote was clearly both a troublesome predator and a source of delight. The reason for this was the coyote is a remarkable survivor in the face of everything. In the 1960s and 70s, I found out that the coyote had invaded Los Angeles. He could be found around the University of California at Los Angeles in the Westwood area. The coyote would feast on cats and dogs in the neighborhood, as well as mice and rats. His boldness was startling. Winters were times of hunger for men and animals. By late winter, many deer and elk and other animals, including some predators, were very hungry. The cold and snow took their toll in burning away of fat. In the struggle to survive, weakened one and all, except the coyote. The coyote was always sleek and fat. He fed on mice and pack rats and also on the weaker large animals, as they had been unable to withstand the predators. Only once did I ever see a mangy, skinny coyote, and that was a very, very old one. Normally, coyotes are in excellent condition. Indian life in the old days was a continuing struggle for survival. A constant supply of food was urgently needed and not readily come by. Hunting and food gathering took up most of the people's time, and the winters were grim. The coyote flourishes in the winter precisely because the other animals grow weaker. It's his opportunity to kill more easily and to live well. His various devices in hunting game that was normally too big or strong for him was thus a delight to the Indian. The coyote had mastered the art of survival. The stories told about a trickster simply celebrating the coyote as a survivor. Once the old Indian life was gone, the stories endured. But the coyote's survival skills no longer won the same appreciation. I can recall the appreciation with which the older Indians described the winter hunting ways of the coyotes, and they relished the animal's skill. And the Indians, as longtime survivors, easily identified with the coyote. Among the Indians of Nevada and California, the coyote was, in one way, a primeval god, the animal out of which mankind had developed. On the other hand, some Navajos held that evil men became coyotes when they died. The coyote was said by some to be the giver of fire to men, and others saw the coyote as a man's creator. Still others viewed him as an appealing devil, an enemy of the creator. The depictions of the coyote vary, but they have in common the fact that he's a trickster and a survivor. This brings us to the problem where the modern Indian is concerned. The older Indians I knew, some of them could recall pre-reservation years, appreciated the ability to survive. But what does the coyote mean to our present-day Native Americans in the West? The answer is, clearly, nothing. Survival in the sense of eating and staying alive is no longer a problem. The reservation is a welfare state, a sad one. The security of reservation life has beggared all Native Americans, yet they demand more. A Shoshone soldier in World War II in the South Pacific relished the island battles. They took him back to the tales of, told by his grandfather. He did exceptionally well by thinking like a coyote. His ability to survive and triumph was remarkable. He admitted that he enjoyed the war because he was outstanding as a soldier. He was a survivor. And that's what the coyote once meant to the Indians. Wow. That's interesting, I think. So, that's one of the chapters in the American Indian.